From WNPR, I'm John Dankosky, and this is The Wheelhouse.
Finally, you'd be giving people back their access to the land they know, to the land they understand.
They're upset because they almost make it sound like digging pots and robbing graves is a sport in Utah. And for me, I find that alarming. Because, you know, as a president, he represents all of us.
The bakery owner out in Denver, Colorado, this guy, Jack Phillips, he's a Christian. He argues that he has a right to refuse to bake a custom wedding cake for same-sex couples.
That is your voice. I was there. You were there. That's your voice on the tape.
But what we do know is that John Dowd has now confirmed to CNN that he was the one who drafted this tweet. But he also told me in an email this morning that he was not the one who posted it.
This is a momentous occasion for the Republican Party. This is a momentous occasion for people who have tried to change the tax code for three decades now. It's worth noting.
We're now one huge step closer to delivering to the American people the historic tax relief as a giant present for Christmas. Remember I said we're bringing Christmas back? Christmas is back bigger and better than ever before. We're bringing Christmas back.
If you'd like to join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. We are talking about the week's news with, Christine Stewart is editor-in-chief at CTNewsJunkie.com. Hi there, Christine. How are you?
I'm good. Good morning.
And Bill Curry's here. He's our Democratic political analyst sitting in ably for Colin McEnroe today. Hi there, Bill.
Which means that all of us, I'm the one who has to treat you politely.
So
good morning, Mr. Dankosky.
You're off to a good start. Harriet Jones is here. She's WNPR's business reporter and editor. Hi there, Harriet.
Good morning, John.
So there's a lot to talk about. I just want to start by noting something that's very important to us here. For years, we have been trailed by the cameras of CTN, the Connecticut Network.
Surveilled.
Surveilled, you might say. They take pictures of a radio show, and then they broadcast them to folks who watch CTN. They're back, and they're in our little studio, and they're taking pictures of us again today. So I have to say, welcome back to CTN, and we're really glad to see their cameras here. And you can watch along at home. There's a lot to talk about. I actually want to start with you, Bill, before we get to a lot of state issues and some other things having to do with the tax bill, what's in it, how it's going to affect Connecticut. Let's just spend a moment or two on one of the big developments in the probe into ties between both the Trump campaign and perhaps the Trump White House to Russia. Of course, some big news coming out about Russia just yesterday that the country that hosted the most recent Summer Olympics is now not going to be taking part in the upcoming Olympics in South Korea because of a doping scandal. But this is a different sort of Russian news, and this comes from the BBC. U.S. Special Counsel Robert Mueller has ordered Germany's Deutsche Bank to provide records of accounts held by Donald Trump, according to these reports. Mueller issued a subpoena to the bank several weeks ago demanding the transaction data, Reuters news agency and a German newspaper say. So, Bill, what does this tell you about how this investigation into the Trump campaign and maybe the Trump White House is ramping up?
First of all, it was a somewhat smaller story because other media outlets haven't yet independently confirmed it. But no one's questioned it, and no one on the Trump side has denied it. So it looks pretty solid from here. And the story is that Mueller has requisitioned the financial records of Donald Trump from within the Deutsche Bank. And he's had a lot of Deutsche Bank activities. So who's Deutsche Bank? One, it's Germany's biggest bank. And two, it's the one legitimate outside bank that continued doing business during the implosion of the banking sector in Moscow. Three, it has paid literally billions of dollars in fines to the Justice Department, to the New York State Financial Protection Agency and others over manipulation of currency rates, over manipulation of interest rates, and biggest of all, over money laundering, Russian oligarch mafia money laundering. And that fine itself is up to $1 billion. Here's the other thing about Deutsche Bank. When every legitimate bank also pulled out of Trump, they pulled out of Trump enterprises around the time they pulled out of Russia. And they pulled out of Trump enterprises because Trump never pays his bills because his creditors all were bankrupted, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And Deutsche Bank continued to lend Trump money. It's a part of, I would just say this, that one thing we've learned if we just step back almost to a certainty is that Trump's financial relationships with a corrupt Russian thugocracy go back to the 1990s, and they are constant, and they involve premier projects of his. And the question here for Robert Mueller is whether or not the two – what I think will ultimately be the two biggest words of all of this, money laundering, whether in fact laundered Russian mafia money was poured into Trump projects by the very practices that they've been paying fines on. And that's what's at issue here. You know, Whitewater, I'll just conclude one observation. The Clinton impeachment began with a look back into a failed real estate deal that was dodgy but not criminal, as people finally determined, including people who hated Clinton. And no one questioned that there should be a look back then. They started that looking back into his prior financial arrangements and activities, Clinton's. In this case, I believe that Trump's entire life has just been one long crime spree. It's a criminal enterprise. I believe that the tracks are everywhere, and that this investigation will lead back into that, and it will also relate directly to the question of collusion, because owing a lot of money to Russian thugs is a really good reason for a guy like Trump to collude.
And this is, of course, all speculation, but it's a path that seems to be
leading. It's a path. That's right. But Mueller's grabbed all those documents, and he can't grab those documents without proving beforehand that he sees a probable cause. So you've got that much right now.
I'm interested, you know, in the speed or otherwise of Mueller's investigation. It's hard for, you know, an outsider to judge, and it's maybe we haven't ever looked in this much detail at one of these investigations proceeding before. So what do you see about, you know, some people feel that it's very slow, but, you know, perhaps other experts say, actually, this is going much faster than we might have expected.
Yes, first of all, majority of the country feels it's going very slow because they wish he were out of there yesterday. But in fact, if you compare it to, think of being in Connecticut, the Roland investigations, how many people sat around and said, God, when is this going to come to a conclusion? This is in their nature. If you compare the pace of this investigation to any major public corruption case, even the Roland investigation, a state level, much smaller thing, you compare it to Watergate, to Ken Starr, this is actually moving at warp speed. This is moving faster than any major public corruption case with which I am familiar in my life. And again, I think it's because Trump talks compulsively to people who don't like him about things that are illegal. He's every prosecutor's dream defendant, and he's made this a lot easier. I've never seen a defendant tweet his own prosecution case on a daily basis in my life, and so that's just moving this thing along.
Well, perhaps we can move along to something that we know is going to affect an awful lot of people, not just here in Connecticut, but all around the country. The new GOP tax bill, we've been trying to figure out what's in it, what's not in it. Here's the thing, Christine, that I think we know more than anything else, is that people here in Connecticut are looking very closely at what it's going to mean to them and for Connecticut, New Jersey, Massachusetts, New York, California, what we'll call the blue states. Right now, it's not looking so good.
No, it's not looking so good. And I think that we saw New York and California and the governors there are actually looking at suing the federal government for double taxation, because right now you're allowed to write off your state income taxes as part of your federal taxes. And so they're saying that basically, essentially, this bill allows us to double tax certain populations. So Connecticut is not part of that yet. The Attorney General's office in here in Connecticut was unable to comment on that yesterday. But I think that we're still trying to figure out what's in this bill. And I think just in a global sense, what happened was they passed it, I don't know, in the wee hours of the morning on Saturday. They were handwriting portions of it as they went. Sounds very much like the Connecticut legislature.
Yeah, that never
sometimes.
Happens here.
Never,
yeah,
happens,
never
here.
Happens here.
Christine was shocked.
I was shocked. And basically, you know, not unlike the Affordable Care Act, Republicans passed this and, you know, you're kind of going like, the more you read it, the more you don't really exactly understand it and what's in it. And I think that Democrats are not going to allow them, like Republicans didn't allow the Democrats to amend the Affordable Care Act and the mistakes that they found at the very last minute. So I think you're going to see kind of a reversal here with the tax package.
So what do we see in this tax package, Harry, that we think, that we know is in there, that we think is going to affect Connecticut in any way? What are some of the things we're looking at?
So that SALT, the state and local tax deduction, is big for a high state tax, high tax state like Connecticut. That's going to hit people here. The mortgage interest deduction is capped in both versions, I believe, of the tax bill that we've seen so far. And again, for a state which has high housing costs, that, you know, could definitely be a hit for people here. There's one very specific measure on crumbling foundations, which is going to be an impact here. Joe Courtney and John Larson had worked very hard with the Treasury and the IRS to have this very specific thing called the casualty loss deduction apply to people who here have this crumbling foundations problem. And just, you know, days before this tax bill passed, they announced, great, people here who have this crumbling foundations problem, who get those foundations repaired, can write off that repair cost in their federal taxes. And, you know, the rug immediately got yanked from under because both these versions change that. I think the House bill takes away the casualty loss deduction entirely, and I think the Senate bill makes it subject to a presidential declaration. So it looks now as if that will now not happen for those homeowners.
And I think, so Tim Heim, who is in charge of the crumbling, the grassroots crumbling foundation organization, said that he thinks that there's probably maybe 100 people that he knows of that might be able to take advantage of this deduction. And Connecticut's delegation are encouraging people to, you know, basically file their taxes early. And if they can, you know, if they can get in under this tax package before it's signed, then they might be able to get some relief.
Yeah, so, just props to Joe Courtney and to John Larson. I was surprised that they were able to finagle this out of the IRS, even though it's the right thing to do. I guess that's what made it so surprising. And again, this is a very specific way in which Connecticut is disadvantaged by these bills. But it goes even bigger. I just want to go back to Harriet's point. I was surprised to learn that I knew houses cost a lot in Fairfield County, but that one out of every five has a mortgage over $500,000. The property tax and interest, in which are all being capped simultaneously, that this will have a huge impact. In Connecticut, even in a weaker, in a relatively weak housing market, our houses cost a lot more than they cost in other mm-hmm. places. This is part of the massive a subsidy of all blue states toward all red states under this bill. Anybody who thinks it's an accident should think again. We already subsidize the most conservative states on the spending side. Almost every red state government-hating politician gets more money from the federal government than his taxpayers pay in. And now we're going to be paying on the tax side. The effect on Connecticut housing just for openers, but then on all those individuals in terms of their own discretionary income in this economy, it's going to be huge.
You call it a subsidy. I mean, another way to look at this is a redistribution of wealth.
That's another way to say it.
I mean,
and by the way, it's Republicans. The vengeance that's been taken out on blue state Republicans by red state Republicans is stunning, because when you take a look at those higher end houses and you look at all these deals, it's the upper middle class, not the very wealthy, but the upper middle class in those states suffers greatly. And that goes to the core of their soon to be their former constituency.
Well, we've seen a lot of people writing about this, Christine, and it gets to the heart of a lot of the things we talk about here each and every week. It's how good is the business climate of Connecticut going to be? Is this a state that's going to attract young people to come stay here? Is it going to be a place that's going to continue to attract high wealth people to be here? I know that this is brand new, but I can't imagine the conversations that are happening at the Capitol right now, because we're facing our own, you know, almost intractable budget problems. We're trying to figure out how we're going to tax and spend our way into some sort of a normalcy here. And now the federal government is coming and sort of pulling the rug out from an already very shaky house of cards. I mean, how is this being treated at the Capitol now?
Yeah, well, there's definitely going to be some budget implications regarding revenue that the state receives from taxpayers. So, you know, we already have a $203 million deficit for fiscal year 2018. And you know, this tax bill is not going to make it, you know, any better. I think we're going to get to April and the problem's going to emerge. And 2 years after this two-year budget, there's already a $4.46 billion deficit built into it. So whoever's the next governor, good luck.
Yeah. Well, and again, whoever's the next governor, good luck. That's about the budget, Harriet. But it's also sort of this Uber problem that we're talking. And I'm not talking about the company Uber, but this overarching problem that kind of suggests bad times for blue states like Connecticut in attracting the type of investment from the outside, the type of high wealth individuals, or even young workers who might want to come here.
Right, and it will be interesting to see what the fallout is from whatever is actually passed. I mean, we do have to bear in mind that this bill now went to conference, so we'll have to see what comes out of the conference committee and then whether it can, again, pass in both houses. So, you know, I don't think we know the final shape of this thing, and it's going to be interesting to see, you know, what does get changed in that process.
Yeah.
And I think as far as these conversations are concerned regarding the economy, I'm not quite sure how much Connecticut's economy, how much it's related to the tax burden, and we can blame taxes on all of this, and how much it's related to just the changes in the economy over the past 10 years. I mean, we didn't have smartphones 10 years ago. We didn't have this technology 10 years ago. And so things are happening, and I don't think that people give enough credit to how things are changing. And at the rapid pace they are.
Christine just got a smartphone. Well, she's pretty excited about it, I think. But, you know, the
Art
other
Laffer
piece of this,
that
John,
phone.
Both in your question and implied in Harriet's answer, again, look at the spending side on all this. Right now, we see pressure on children's health care. The 9 million children across this country on the CHIPS program. We see 13 million people losing Obamacare coverage. One of the points that Republicans dismiss, but which is unavoidable to anyone with the merest grasp of what's happening here, is that the pressure on the spending side is going to be overwhelming. And that's pressure on Medicare. That's pressure on Social Security. That's where all the money is. It's the, you know, why do you rob banks? That's where the money is. Well, the banks to be robbed in a fight over spending are the fundament of the social contract in America, and they hit hardest of all older voters. Although we're starting out with a fair share of millennials and a disproportionate number of children. And so even as we're passing this, we're seeing the first ripples of an just a possibly huge effect. Right now, I think, you know, 9 million and 13 million, those are huge numbers. Those are huge numbers. And it's happening right now because of the pressure. When it comes back to Connecticut, the next piece of pressure, when the states broke, they cheat the towns in most places, and when the federal government's broke, they pulled the plug on the states. And so when you look at the numbers that Christine is talking about, and then you add into those not just the added economic problem, but the federal withdrawal of support from that coming from the next big budget coming up, that truly is frightening.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, there's some other really big news happening in the state this week, primarily a deal between Aetna, the big insurance company just down the street from us, and CVS. You know CVS. They're on every single street corner in America. Well, we're going to talk a little bit more about what Aetna-CVS merger means for Connecticut and for the country with Bill Curry, our Democratic political analyst, Christine Stewart from CTNewsJunkie.com, Harriet Jones from WNPR. This is The Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. We're talking about the week's news with Harriet Jones, who's the business reporter for WNPR. Christine Stewart is editor-in-chief at ctnewsjunkie.com, and Bill Curry is our Democratic political analyst. Colin McEnroe is away. I believe he's in Italy, which sounds
just
lovely.
Or he's home in bed reading. He's just a lazy slug. You know, like, believe me, I could tell such stories.
He might be in Italy.
Just around the world.
He's probably streaming this right now in Italy.
Of course,
hi, Colin. 860-275-7266 if you want to join the conversation. Bill Curry touched on this, Harriet, but just to put a little finer point in it, reading from the Hartford Courant here, notices sent out later this month to the parents of 17,000 Connecticut children and teens covered by the federal Children's Health Insurance Program, warning them their coverage could end early next year if Congress doesn't act soon. And the governor's, you know, speaking up about this.
Yeah, so this is CHIP. The national program is called CHIP, Children's Health Insurance Program, but the name for it here is Husky B. So this is a program that's administered by the state but funded by the federal government through CHIP. And as you say, the governor put some numbers on it for this state, I think with a letter that just went out within the last week. 17,000 kids are insured under CHIP or Husky B. And he's saying, basically, we're going to have to start notifying those families that, you know, probably by the end of January, middle of February, their coverage is going to end unless the federal government does something about re-upping CHIP.
Mm.
And I think we've all forgotten, oh, by the way, the federal government runs out of money on Friday.
That's true.
Yeah, the federal government, well, we should just touch on that.
Chicken Little over here.
Sorry.
As of right now, they run out of money on Friday.
Just in case anybody, you know, had forgotten.
And that's another thing that has to be addressed one way or the other, or else a whole series of other dominoes fall, and we can't imagine that.
Yeah,
that's
no,
happen,
and, you know, I think that there are some people hoping that they do address this issue when they address, hopefully, they address the budget and pass some sort of continuing resolution.
I want to move on to a big deal between Aetna and CVS. Aetna, of course, has been, well, not only a big employer here, but kind of a hallmark of Hartford business for such a long time. Mark Bertolini, the CEO, is going to move the headquarters to New York, where he seems to like to spend a little bit more time. Now, all of a sudden, there's this big deal, $69 billion, where CVS, now that's the same CVS that you see on every street corner, well, they're going to buy up Aetna, the nation's third largest insurer. I think a lot of the questions we have are, what exactly is this going to look like? I know Bill has some thoughts about whether or not this is good for healthcare in America, Harriet. But first, I want to just hear from you about what all is in this deal. I mean, what do we know about it?
So it's kind of a merger of big Northeast giants, if you like, because, of course, Rhode Island-based CVS and Hartford-based Aetna coming together. CVS is buying Aetna, and this is part of a new shape of consolidation is going on in healthcare. We've seen lots of consolidation in providers, big hospital groups buying up physician groups and that type of thing. Similar kind of thing is happening within insurance. And basically, the CVS we know is all of those, you know, corner stores where we go to get our prescriptions. But actually, the kind of more interesting part of CVS and where they really make their money is they are a pharmacy benefits manager, which is an entity that negotiates drug prices between the manufacturers and the insurers. So what Aetna is, what's really interesting about this coming together is that Aetna will now be partnered with this pharmacy benefits manager entity, which makes it more of a one-stop shop. It's also talking about how it will change It's framing this as a new front door to healthcare. So we're talking about using CVS's, you know, 10,000 stores as a kind of one-stop shop for people going in. Maybe they're, you know, maybe the way that they interact with their insurance is made easier. They can get all kinds of services. We now see minute clinics in CVS's, so maybe they're getting more of their kind of primary care from a CVS.
So if you have a problem with your health insurance, you stand in line behind a guy buying bubble gum, and you get a very long receipt at the end. Is that what they're thinking about?
I mean, who knows what the actual reality will turn out to be. They're selling this as your interaction with the American healthcare system will be smooth. It will be much easier. We're not going to see all these kind of, you know, bills coming back to you and big long lines. What the reality actually turns out to be in the end, we don't know yet, because this type of deal hasn't ever been done in the past.
And they're going to say that there's cost savings built into this, that, you know, they're going to be able to save you money by, you know, consolidating these things. And there's, you know, still questions about whether the consumer is actually going to see a benefit from all of this consolidation.
But not the type of cost savings and consolidation you usually see with big mergers between healthcare companies, right, where you get two healthcare giants that basically do the same sort of thing. They collide together and they shed a whole bunch of people and maybe change up a headquarters so they're saving money. It's two different kinds of companies merging here.
Right. So it's very much like, I want to say, the Amazon Whole Foods deal, you know, so two very different types of company merging and, you know, offering a product that's going to be possibly different.
Now, when I talked to you about this bill yesterday in preparation for this, I was somewhat surprised to hear that it's not like you love this deal, but that you see a little silver lining here, perhaps, maybe.
We could name one of the less, slightly less precious metals, I'd cop to it. But but let me just say that yes, and if you were to premise your analysis on the idea that all meaningful healthcare reform has failed and will not succeed,
so let's
and
start
wanted
from
to
there.
Know and wanted to know what would we do with the system, I would just point out the following. As Christine and Harriet both alluded to, there are potential savings, and there are potential efficiencies here. They are not the customary and most obvious ones, and some analysts have already said, Wall Street analysts have already said they don't see them. But But there are savings available. But it's sort of like this tax bill and 20 other things I could cite that or the bailout of in 2008 when they gave the banks $1 trillion and the hope that they would lend it to businesses, and then they didn't. They just speculated in the marketplace. The tax bill says they're going to bring all this money back, and then they'll spend it on jobs and wage increases. Except when do they do that? And the question here is when you create a behemoth like this and now an integrated healthcare colossus, what is their inclination to pass the savings on to the consumers? Well, market theory says it's only as great as the pressure on them to do so. And sometimes that pressure has to come to the government. What it thought to me, my thoughts on this are somewhat obscure to many. I would just point two things out. One, we've had a complete collapse of healthcare regulation, just like all regulation of commerce, only worse in America. And the one silver lining is that antitrust regulators may actually prove more proficient than healthcare policy regulators at stepping in here and stopping something. But the upside is for them, if you can't get a better system, a public option would do this much better. Single payer would do this much better. If you've actually – what you're going to have here now, though, is a private, largely unregulated a company which is integrating a set of services into one organization so that many of the costs are going to be of primary care, not critical care, but primary care, drugs, fraud and inefficiency, and overhead. They're now in one organization finally, and they will get savings out of that in the end. What they'll do with them is anybody's guess.
I think that's an interesting point that, and I think Mark Bersellini made this point when the deal was announced, that, we haven't seen an efficient kind of evolution of healthcare reform in this country. So in a sense, the private companies are taking it upon themselves. How is this landscape shaped in the future?
And one, there's two problems here. One, I just point out, there's a tacit admission in the market doing this of the efficiencies of single payer. There's a tacit admission that this present fractured free-for-all healthcare marketplace is simply untenable, and that to survive, it has to change. Two, as a warning to all people who want real reform, this will also be a more politically powerful, an even more politically powerful player in our democracy, and that means that real reform is going to be even harder.
Well, so and there's also this angle where I guess they've said that this merger has happened or, they want this merger to happen between CVS and Aetna because they're afraid that Amazon is going to get into this business very soon. So, I think that's just another warning of these mega mammoth companies and consolidation of all these services.
It's all to prepare us for the Google-Facebook merger.
I think one of the interesting things that we really don't know yet is the effect on Connecticut because, of course, Aetna employs 6,000 people here. So it's, it's a very major player in our economy. One of the things that's now up in the air with this merger is will the headquarters really move to Manhattan?
Yes.
My bet is no, because why would they spend $85 million building a fancy building in Lower Manhattan?
CVS stayed in Rhode Island.
Right.
Maybe Bertolino will have to go to Providence now.
He's going to enjoy that.
Yeah.
So, that seems to me, a very obvious thing that will change in their plans. But how will employment be affected in Connecticut? And I think that's really not clear yet. They issued a statement to me the other day saying, this is about expansion, not contraction. Our employees are going to be needed to implement the kind of healthcare, the health insurance piece of this. So they're not off the bat saying that they're looking for savings in terms of employment, but they have said that they're looking for $750 million in efficiencies. So where does that come from?
And at the same time, they're also looking for, so my friends that I have at Aetna are really struggling to find the workers to fill the positions for the technology jobs that these insurance giants are becoming. They're becoming more technology companies at this point. So, can Connecticut provide, a place for these technology wizards to live and survive and enjoy themselves?
The last thing before we move on from this, Bill, is just a theory that I put out to you when we were talking yesterday that, if it's my little silver or tinfoil lining in a big behemoth merger like this, it's that because CVS is a primary provider of services and because they exist on every street corner in America or sometimes four out of every corner in America, there's a way in which the consumer has a front door to actually affect some sort of change. So if people don't like what CVS Aetna is doing, they can do something, whereas if they didn't like what the old Aetna was doing, they didn't really have a recourse, right? Their employer had an Aetna plan. They couldn't do much more than call up and yell. There may be a different relationship in the future with a company like this when people just say, no, I don't like this. I'll go walk across the street to Walgreens.
And first of all, I think that's true. And there is a piece here where we've been trying to figure out how to get primary health care to people, even people on Medicaid. The children don't get it because of the service delivery system. The average person uninsured doesn't get any. Even many people now who are insured have deductibles that are too big. You go into the CVS now, you get a for an inoculation on a, you know, for a flu shot. Maybe you'll go for a blood pressure check, maybe various heart diseases, maybe a culture swab. Actually, you could get to a pretty extensive walk-in clinic before it all ends, and you've got drugs. It's a, you have a way here to deal with that part of the cost problem within that network. Maybe at that point, the only save – however, you'll see two or three other mergers just like it, and at that point, you really will be relying on antitrust. This is monopoly capitalism's answer to single payer, and it's better than what we have, but it's not nearly what we need. And for the thing that Harriet does such an extraordinary job of reporting on in this station, the welfare of small businesses, to argue that this will give them more choices, which is what the medical establishment always claiming will say will save the marketplace, it won't. And the idea that it will reduce their costs when those costs have to be reduced for them to survive, I just don't quite see it.
I mean, to your point about, you know, can't you just walk into Walgreens? If you're insured with Aetna, I bet you they're going to make it much more expensive for you to walk into Walgreens.
And they very well – until the Walgreens, Whole Foods, Amazon merger of 2018, which will make things all the easier.
Such a pessimist,
and to Bill's point about, you know, we're just going to see expanding health services within CVS, I think that's true. And I think the hospitals are very scared about that. And I saw a commentary from a physician the other day saying one thing that was never mentioned in all of this was doctors. You know.
And there won't be a regulatory commission capable of overseeing this. In other countries where there are privatized models, Switzerland, for instance, there is fierce public regulation, and the insurance is done on a nonprofit basis. Here you have non-regulated for-profit, and at a scale and at a level of complexity which befuddles any consumer.
Well, I just want to say quickly, too, before we feel too bad for Mark Bertolini, maybe not getting the big fancy Manhattan headquarters. Looks like he may walk away from this deal with something like $500 million or something like that.
He gets a consolation prize, for sure.
A little bit of a consolation prize.
You were the only one weeping. Let me just get in our little group right here.
You can buy yourself a very nice, as they say, flat in Manhattan for that. When we come back from our break, we're going to talk a little bit about state politics, who is running for governor and who's running for AG, whether or not some of the people who are running for AG can actually be AG. We're also going to talk about what's happening in the state capitol with Christine Stewart from CTNewsJunkie.com, Harriet Jones from WNPR, and Bill Curry. I'm John Dankosky. This is The Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. We're talking about the week's news with Bill Curry, Harriet Jones from WNPR, and Christine Stewart from CTNewsJunkie.com. Legislative leaders set to meet with Governor Malloy to talk a bit more about the deficit. Yeah, again, a deficit. I don't know, Christine. We keep going round and round about this. We have a new budget deal, and we've got a budget deficit. What's happening?
Yeah, so we have a new budget deal that the governor did not negotiate, and legislative leaders now have this deficit, and now it's to the point where it's 1% of the general fund, which means the governor has to come up with a deficit mitigation plan for a budget that he did not negotiate. So we have sort of an interesting dynamic, and the legislature is in this position, Republicans and Democrats, to defend this budget.
Yeah, and so here's a question. Would this governor, if given the authority or the mandate to make cuts to a budget that he was left out of, would he do things that the legislature wants him to do or not?
Yeah, I think he would do things that he doesn't think that the legislature wants him to do. So
I just think
that's what's going to happen, and there's nothing that they can do.
Yeah.
There's nothing they can do about it.
Yeah. And are we in a position, once again, where we are fixing a problem for a very short period of time? I mean, we started the program talking quite a bit about taxes. and whether or not tax revenue down the road is going to be coming to Connecticut as expected. I mean, are we expecting to have one of these years in which every couple months we get another revenue estimate and we're back at the same spot? We're trying to negotiate a new budget fix because we're back in deficit.
Yeah, and I don't think anybody anticipated the changes at the federal level as part of this budget negotiation. So I think come April, you know, last April we saw a drop of revenues of $470 million. I think it's going to be even greater this year.
They didn't see it coming.
Wah, wah.
They didn't. They didn't see a Republican president and a Republican Congress maybe wanting to push forward some sort of big tax changes.
Yeah, no, and I don't think they anticipated the drop in federal funding that they've experienced.
Mm, okay.
Which is a mere fraction of what they may anticipate if nothing changes between now and then. It's amazing to me. I just want to say, you know, with all the bad feeling we all have about the state, we all hear about the state all the time. I want to repeat something I've said here before, which is that the 500-pound gorilla in our economy is our state government itself. And the fact our state is hobbled but not paralyzed. It's in poor shape but not in crisis. The government is in crisis. That the state's doing as well as it can with the government doing this poorly is actually testimony to its underlying resilience and to the many resources we have at our disposal. But this – to just go back to one of the things I said before about the flow of revenues from the federal government to the states and how it's favored the red states over the blue states all of my life since I was born, and it's disadvantaged us. When these cuts come in and that money is withdrawn from the Connecticut economy, you can look first at the budgetary impact on the poor, the old, the very young, the disabled. But when you can also step back and look at the effect on our economy, and it will make it much, much harder. We can pull this thing up, but that will just be one more huge dead weight around our necks.
A lot of people would say, well, Bill, they've been doing that to you all this time. Why didn't you move to Florida like the rest of America?
I'm leaving later on this afternoon, and I just want to say this has been great. I'll be in, I don't know, whatever they have down there. Name some fancy beach. I can't think of any of them.
I just very quickly before we turn to some state political races, MGM Resorts International's top executive returned to the Bridgeport area Tuesday to talk about his plan to build a $675 million resort casino in the city. We're back to talking about a Bridgeport casino in this fight to the death, it seems, Harriet, between MGM, which has the Springfield Casino, and the two tribal nations here who have their own casinos?
Yeah, that was kind of a fun little spat yesterday. So James Murren, who is the CEO of MGM and who is a Bridgeport native, you know, the Bridgeport Casino, in some senses is kind of a little personal project for him. He came back to talk to the business council there to tout that the state should be changing its gaming policy or, you know, looking at the compacts somehow to allow MGM to build that casino. That afternoon, a couple hours before he spoke, the partnership, MMCT, which is the tribal partnership, which wants to build the casino in East Windsor.
In league with the state.
Indeed. Yes. They put out a fun little video casting doubt, perhaps, on whether MGM thinks this Bridgeport casino is ever really going to happen. So.
Fun times.
It is fun times.
Well, and they've actually, you know, so the state has actually had to sue the Department of Interior to get them to actually say whether they can go for it or not with this East Windsor casino.
And so, where are we, timing-wise, Christine? I mean, where are we? Are we ever going to get movement on that East Windsor casino?
So they need to be getting some shovels in the ground if they want it to open in time for the MGM project in Springfield is supposed to open in 2018. So we're closing in on that.
And it's December, Bill, and it's hard to get those shovels in the ground
you
this
know,
time.
I just want to say another marriage proposal from the gambling industry to the city of Bridgeport. What could possibly go wrong with that union? And I would also point out, again, thinking about small businesses and the recognition that we're not – we need to be out of the corporate bribery economic development strategy and into a small business development strategy, our own homegrown. I talked to so many business leaders in Fairfield County who said that the simple strain on infrastructure, transportation infrastructure, what does Route 95 need but, you know, a couple of million gamblers going to Bridgeport to pretty much shut down that system? We have to take a hard look at the resources we have and how we wish to apply them. And this is if anyone thinks that gambling has really led to the economic resurgence of Connecticut, I would just say, again, take a closer look.
Well, and I'll just quickly say, though, Harriet, I think much like we tend to overestimate all sorts of things in terms of a rosy economy or new tax revenues or job numbers, and we fall short, a lot of the projections about what gambling is going to do as far as attracting people to a new casino, whether that's in East Windsor or Bridgeport, that's not necessarily borne out by the numbers that we've been seeing at the tribal casinos over quite some time. I mean, Bill's talking about the worry of clogging I-95 with new gamblers coming up from New York City, but I don't know, there's a lot of other choices. And
would
that's
they
not,
come?
Well,
I mean, there's certainly, you know, many studies that show that perhaps the market is getting saturated in the Northeast, and building another casino doesn't necessarily bring you know, a ton of new people. It's just circulating the same people amongst different, different facilities. But I think Southeastern Connecticut might argue with you a little bit that, you know, gaming hasn't been good for the state. Certainly historically over the last 20 years, I mean, gaming had a big part to play in sustaining Southeast Connecticut's economy when we saw the dip in Electric Boat. Now Electric Boat is climbing again. So, things are going in cycles. But, you know, I think
an impoverished area and brought some jobs.
Yeah, I think that the effect of gaming on Connecticut is more complex than you're representing.
I think that's a fair point. Although I would say that its effect on small businesses in Southeastern Connecticut has been more in line with what I just described. But that's for a show that John's going to invite us both back for.
We'll have a good fight then.
Well, let's turn a little bit to some of the political maneuverings, Christine. And before we get to the newly energized race for attorney general, you attended a Democratic debate. I guess they're calling them debates or forums.
What are they calling?
And this was sort of the Democrats happenings. Who are courting the progressive vote.
Yeah, so it was a good debate in that it was very well run. There are so many candidates now who are going to have to be on stage before we get to the primary, that not doing introductions of these candidates was really helpful. And the way that the debate was formatted by forcing them to say yes or no to questions before being given an opportunity to elaborate on them was pretty genius, in my opinion.
Were people told who they actually were? Did people have to guess who they were?
No,
on stage?
They had this mingling event. Well, I mean, they didn't have to guess who they were. I mean, their names were there. But I mean, you know, people who are in the audience are people who are involved in politics and people who are, you know, with a party or affiliated with a party and interested in this political process.
And what did you hear them saying, if anything interesting, to this group of you know, progressives?
So this group, we had Bridgeport Mayor Joe Ganim, Middletown Mayor Dan Drew, we had Dita Bhagava from Greenwich, and we had Jonathan Harris from West Hartford. And so what I heard after the debate was that Jonathan Harris did much better than people expected him to. And after the debate, Jonathan was like, people forget I had like a 95% AFL-CIO voting record when I was in the state Senate. And so I think it provided an opportunity for him to, you know, get himself out there a little bit more.
Two points. One, all over America, every Democrat running for office or seeking a nomination for office sounds unbelievably like Bernie Sanders. Everybody sounds like a progressive. And when you go to a progressive event like that, the effect is even more so. Unfortunately, my party still does most of this on the level of message rather than policy. And distinguishing what these people actually think and what they would actually commit to will require very, very – more than yes or no questions. I appreciate what the format was, but a lot more digging. And the second thing is there's a great challenge to progressivism itself here because we have to distinguish between the government's role as rulemaker and as service provider. And the pressure on government's role as service provider is about to be overwhelming. And that model for how we've been liberals for, again, all of my life is under such strain. And demonstrating that there is a way to be a reformer, that there's a way to get a social change, a positive change by changing the rules, not just by writing the checks, is going to be a discussion. And that discussion is going to have to involve an honest statement of the state's true financial condition, which for progressives will be very hard to hear.
And certainly very hard to say about anybody who's involved in Connecticut state government right now. Before we turn to the AG, let's quickly talk about some GOP gubernatorial candidates. So the flip side of this, Christine, is people running for the GOP side of the ticket actually talking about state tax cuts. We're going to cut the income tax now?
Yeah. So there's two Republican gubernatorial candidates who are talking about cutting the state income tax over a period of 8 years or 10 years, depending on which one you're talking about. So, you know, I don't know how you take away a revenue stream at the time that the state is already struggling to provide the services it's providing with the revenue streams that it has, which just keep on dwindling.
Growth, Harriet, right? It's always growth. This is what happens.
Give people back their money, they spend it. I don't know. It's something like that. Trickle down.
Well, how does that economic growth get back into the budget? As I mean, if you're only left with a sales tax at 6.35%, how do you grow that sales tax to a point to support an entire $20 billion budget?
But you could certainly see, Bill, this being an attractive potential policy, as we are saying even this morning, that because of federal tax changes, we might not be able to write off as many of our state taxes as we have. I mean, all of a sudden, I don't know, tax cuts to our income tax might be really appealing to people looking for a gubernatorial candidate.
Sure. I mean, it's always, you know, so's a rock, candy, mountain kind of. I mean, you can promise anything. I would just say, I'd point out in response to what Christine was saying, that when you make a campaign promise that the voter has to not just elect you, but reelect you twice in order to see fulfilled, this is by its very definition a campaign promise you don't have to pay a lot of attention to. I remember in 1994, John Rowland running on an absolute, earnest, heartfelt promise to repeal the income tax. He never even had a meeting about it. What they're talking about, these guys are all in like a permanent suborbital trajectory. There isn't a prayer of that happening in a state that's under this much fiscal pressure.
Perhaps we should all send them to on a field trip to Wisconsin, and they can discuss tax cuts in Wisconsin.
They could
before
start
try it here.
Kansas, we could send
or,
them.
Or Kansas.
Yeah, they might never come back.
Hey, we're here in Connecticut, it's
just something they're doing for the campaign.
It's not Kansas anymore. Let's actually turn to the AG's race. So Chris Matty, who was going to be running for governor, switched after George Jepson said he was getting out of the race. He's not going to run again to be attorney general. The question is Chris Matty, a very interesting candidate, best known for putting former Governor John Rowland in jail a second time, is he actually going to be qualified to run in this race? Because there's the Susan Bisewitz problem, right? You have all sorts of arcane rules for who can be attorney general in the state of Connecticut.
Yeah, so we have that decision from the Supreme Court regarding what it constitutes, the constitutional definition of attorney general. And so it's 10 years. And so Chris Matty has been a member of the Connecticut Bar since 2005. And so I think Dan Clow had asked this question on his blog post the other day. And he said that, you know, based on the Supreme Court's decision, he thinks that Chris Matty is qualified to run for attorney general.
He's been a member of the bar, but there's a question of being a litigator. And
but you know what? There's also Representative William Tong, who is running for this position, and his campaign also might be spreading information to question, you know, Chris Matty's legitimacy to run for attorney general. But I think that Chris Matty would say, bring it on, go ahead, take me to court if you want to. I will happily go over my record and my resume.
I just put on two things. One, just a question for the general consideration. Does Susan Bisewitz still have a Susan Bisewitz problem?
So actually, we don't know about that.
So okay.
So what's interesting is Susan Bisewitz has had an exploratory committee to run for the state Senate in the 13th district, which is Meriden and Middletown. Interestingly, there's a Windsor Democratic Town Committee agenda for January 4th, which has her speaking to them as a gubernatorial candidate. So I think that we may see some changes very soon.
Okay. I would just like to say one thing about the Matty question. One, I actually disagree. Michael Sheldon, a brilliant judge, a great, great man, ruled in Bisewitz's favor in that case. And I still think that was the right decision that Michael made, that whatever you thought of Susan as a candidate, that's a statute to be reinterpreted with the utmost liberality, and in the absence of a legislative record, the decision goes to the people to make the choice. And as for Chris Matty, people were questioning his qualifications when he was running for governor. Now they're questioning his opportunism for running for this office. It's sort of you can't get anything. His background on public corruption. This is an office for which his qualifications are not in doubt, and his background in public corruption will serve him very well in this.
Bill Curry is our Democratic political analyst. Always good to see you, Bill. Thank you so much for filling in for Colin today.
My great pleasure. Did I do okay?
You did a great job.
Yeah,
you did a great job. We'll talk more after. Harriet Jones, WNPR's business reporter and editor. Thanks so much, Harriet.
Oh, you're welcome.
And Christine Stewart, editor-in-chief at ctnewsjunkie.com. Thanks so much, Christine.
Thanks, John.
Our program produced by Katie Talarski, our executive producer. Our technical producer is Kyone Wolf. health. You can find more at WNPR.org/thewheelhouse. And thanks to CTN for being here. Good to see you guys.